Hi, this is Jen. It's Friday, April 10th, and I'm reading today's edition of the Providence Journal. 13 injured in fire, explosion at plant. East Providence mayor says no danger remains. 13 people were transported to a local hospital following an explosion at Aspen Aerogels in East Providence. According to a news release issued by the city, East Providence police and firefighters responded at 8:14 p.m. Wednesday, April 8th, to the Aspen Aerogels facility at 3 Dexter Road for a report of an explosion and fire inside the facility. As of 10:15 p.m., there were no reports of major injuries, the release said. A mass casualty incident has been declared, which activates mutual aid services from throughout the region and puts hospitals on notice in the region, the release said. In a video posted to the city's Facebook page, Mayor Bob DeSilva said the explosion occurred in a manufacturing machinery area, which caused significant damage to the machinery. He said the incident was isolated to that area and there is no further danger. There is no danger to the surrounding community, no chemical leaks or anything like that, DeSilva said. In addition to mutual aid provided by several agencies, including the Central Falls, Cranston, Lincoln, Pawtucket, Providence, Seekonk, Massachusetts, and Smithfield Fire Departments, the Office of the State Fire Marshal has been notified and responded. All traffic is being diverted away from Dexter Road and motorists are urged to avoid the area. No further information was immediately available. According to its website, Aspen Aerogel optimizes the performance and safety of electric vehicles and energy infrastructure assets. Lawmakers to consider a variety of gun bills. The two worlds of Rhode Island collided at the State House again on Wednesday, April 8th, when hundreds of gun owners showed up in their signature yellow T-shirts to do battle against proposed new restrictions on their firearms. The lines were drawn between those who own guns and those who want to ban certain types of firearms from Rhode Island. One side of this now annual debate believes that the ownership of high-powered semi-automatic firearms makes Rhode Island more dangerous. The other side believes that Rhode Island would become more dangerous if they had to live here unarmed. On the sidelines is Attorney General Peter Noronha with this message in his annual gun crimes report, which was recently released. Whether gun crimes have trended up or down in 2025, they have trended up a bit, is almost a moot point when a community as tight-knit as Rhode Island is still mourning in the aftermath of the mass shootings at Brown University in December and Pawtucket's Dennis M. Lynch Arena in February. The debate that began at 4 p.m. in the House Judiciary Committee stretched into the night. What is being proposed? The bill that has drawn the most attention so far would outright ban the possession of assault weapons 1 year after lawmakers, as a compromise, approved a controversial ban on the sale and manufacture of those weapons after July 1, 2026. Put simply, the bills would add the word possess to this sentence already in law. No person shall manufacture, sell, offer to sell, transfer, or purchase a prohibited firearm except as otherwise authorized. When would it go into effect? Rhode Islanders who own a prohibited firearm purchased before July 1, 2026 would have until December 31, 2026 to destroy, sell, or transfer the firearm to a federally licensed firearms dealer or an individual who can lawfully possess that firearm. What is the punishment? Convictions for violating the law would come with a punishment of up to 10 years in prison or a fine of up to $10,000, and the prohibited firearm would be forfeited. Arguments for and against a ban on owning assault weapons. Arianna Wool, board chair of the Rhode Island Coalition Against Gun Violence, began her own testimony with what she called the broader context. Today is the 98th day of the year, and so far there have been 99 mass shootings in the U.S. Given that the legislature has already determined that it is it is too dangerous to buy and sell this class of firearms in Rhode Island, shouldn't it be too dangerous to have them as well? Sidney Monstream Quass of Barrington, a former leader in the state's gun control movement, argued that last year's already controversial ban on the sale and manufacture of assault weapons, which include rifles, such as the AR-15 used in many mass shootings, didn't go far enough. It did not, for example, cover certain assault-style pistols and shotguns, and its stopping short of outright banning possession makes it difficult to enforce, leaving dangerous weapons in circulation and falling short of our neighboring state's standards. On the other side came many identically worded letters of objection urging lawmakers to oppose the bill and defend the rights of law-abiding Rhode Islanders. This legislation would force Rhode Islanders to surrender justly acquired private property under threat of criminal penalties. That is an unacceptable infringement on fundamental rights, one such letter reads. Others expressed betrayal after last year's compromise stopped short of banning possession of the specified firearms, interpreting the deal as a promise that they could keep the guns they already own. Bait and switch, said one gun owner. The proposed assault weapons ban was not, however, the only bill on the House Judiciary Committee's April 8th hearing calendar that drew impassioned advocates on both sides of the annual gun debate. What other gun bills are up for debate? There are 17 bills on Wednesday night's hearing calendar. Some of them are backed by the state's gun lobby, including one to provide a clearer appeal route for someone denied a handgun permit by their local police department. But the majority go in the other direction, including the proposed Rhode Island Firearm Industry Accountability Act, which would make anyone engaged in the manufacture, distribution, importation, marketing, wholesale, or retail sale of firearm industry products legally liable if their actions led to a reasonably foreseeable risk of harm. The National Rifle Association, when rallying members to come to the State House, described the slate of bills as lawmakers' most aggressive gun ban package ever in a message packed with buzzwords such as gun rationing and range harassment. Do any of the bills have a chance of passing this year? Maybe. When asked that question a month ago, Senate Majority Leader Frank Ciccone rated the chances the legislature will pass another gun bill this year as 50-50. I think the sentiment of last year was that we're going to pass a bill that's going to be a compromise that everyone can live with, said Ciccone, a licensed gun dealer. I think we've done enough, he said. There are enough laws. But several key lawmakers believe that Noronha's bill, H8081, which would allow a law enforcement agency to consider expunged records before issuing a concealed carry permit for a handgun, has the best shot. Current law allows someone whose criminal record has been expunged, which effectively means removed from public view, to state on any application for employment, license, or other civil right or privilege that he or she has never been convicted of a crime. The only exceptions now are applicants for a job in law enforcement, for admission to the bar of any court, for a teaching certificate, or a position in any early childhood education facility. But there are a number of bills to expand Rhode Island's current law to allow the expungement of multiple felonies, not just a single conviction. One such bill has already won Senate approval. The bill that House Judiciary Chairwoman Carol McEntee put in for Noronha would add another category to the list of convicted criminals who would be required to disclose their past convictions, those applying for a license or permit to carry a handgun. The argument for it, that the bill appropriately balances the intent of expungement, providing individuals with a second chance, with the responsibility of law enforcement to assess risk when issuing permits to carry firearms, wrote Sidney Wardell, executive director of the Rhode Island Police Chiefs Association, in his written testimony. The argument against? Expunge equals to blot or strike out, erase. Expunged records can now be brought back to be used against individuals. Bad piece of legislation, wrote Maurice Leroux of Burleville. The second bill, H-8067, would disqualify anyone with a prior felony conviction from purchasing or possessing a firearm. The ACLU of Rhode Island is among the opponents, arguing that the ban would be too broad, even though federal law bars ex-felons from possessing firearms. Bomb squad called over mortar shells found in Smithfield attic. The discovery of two World War II-era mortar shells at a Smithfield residence prompted a response by the Office of the State Fire Marshal's bomb squad on Monday afternoon, April 6th. The bomb squad removed the two shells, and the area was deemed safe without further incident, the Smithfield Police Department said in a press release. The police were called to the residence at 6 Church Street at about 2:55 p.m. Monday. The caller was reportedly cleaning and discovered the items in the attic, the police said. The police contacted the bomb squad. "We do get these from time to time. It's not as unusual as you might expect," said James Gibbon, Chief Deputy Fire Marshal for Rhode Island. "It's stuff that Grandpa, or in this case maybe Great-Grandpa, brought back from the war," Gibbon said. "Grenades are a more common discovery," he said. As a kid delivering the Providence Journal in the 1970s, Gibbon had a World War II veteran customer who kept two shells on a table in his living room. As of Wednesday morning, the bomb squad was still examining the 75-millimeter shells to determine if they were live, Gibbon said. Ethics panel clears Thorson on free lunch during trip. Former Rhode Island Director of Administration James Thorson's free private lunch in Philadelphia 3 years ago, which critically damaged his career, did not violate the state ethics code, a state panel ruled Wednesday, April 8th. Eating his share of the $524 lunch paid for by a would-be state contractor was poor judgment, Ethics Commission members said, mitigated in part by the nightmare nature of a business trip where all hell had broken loose. The gift was more than $25, and the gift was from an interested person, Commission member Scott Rabideau said before the vote on whether a violation of the state employee gift ban had occurred. "What was less clear to me was whether the prosecution made the case that it was a knowing and willful violation." The 7-member commission voted unanimously that Thorson had not used his office to enrich himself and had not used a state procurement for personal benefit. On a third count, that he had violated the state employee prohibition on gifts from entities with state business, the vote was 2-5. "I was very concerned that the question about payment only came up after the fact, and maybe after a conversation with other administrative officials," said Commissioner Holly Susie, who joined Michael Browner in voting against Thorson. "I understand it was a difficult trip to Philadelphia that day, and things were probably confusing with what happened there with an employee who was having some issues, but I expect better of someone who is leading the Department of Administration." The decision should close the book on a strange chapter in Rhode Island politics when two high-ranking officials went to Philadelphia to save the vacant Cranston Street Armory and returned with free vegan cheese and outraged national headlines. How did we get here? In a rare 2-day Ethics Commission trial over the civil charges, Thorson distanced himself and his reputation from the erratic, offensive behavior of freebie-grabbing subordinate David Patton, who last year agreed to pay $5,000 to settle an ethics complaint against him. Patton and Thorson flew to Philadelphia to tour the Bach building, which had been redeveloped by the same firm that was pitching a $56 million armory redevelopment plan, Scout Limited. Patton, who worried colleagues thought might be having a manic episode the previous night, made inappropriate remarks to tenants while securing free shoes, cheese, and the lunch at Irwin's. Patton told Thorson that lunch was on him, but no check was brought to the table, and Scout covered the tab until reporters began asking about the Friday trip the following Monday, and Thorson emailed Scout for the bill. Thorson's attorney said their client didn't pay for the lunch because Patton had offered to. Ethics Commission prosecutor Jason Grammett pointed out that the ethics code prohibits state employees from giving gifts to their supervisors, so if Patton had paid, that also would have been a violation. The defense is that the respondent didn't believe that he had violated the code by accepting a gift from a vendor because he had intended to violate the code by accepting a gift from a subordinate, Grammett said. Either of those would have violated the gift rule. But Commission Chairman Lauren Jones said Thorson had acted reasonably in asking for the bill the following Monday. I don't think it was an after-the-fact cover situation, Jones said, and I do believe that Mr. Thorson exercised a reasonable degree of monitoring and restraining Mr. Patton during the events on that day, including his asking about certain things that Mr. Patton had acquired. Was it worth it? Leaving the Ethics Commission after the decision, Thorson told reporters that he didn't know if the ruling would repair his reputation, but that he is glad he had refused to settle the case. Because I didn't do anything wrong, he said. It was a tough situation, and I don't think anyone feels good about it, but I am glad I stuck with it. On the Cranston Street Armory, Thorson said he is sad that no progress has been made in repurposing the 19th century fortress. I really do think there should be a way to figure out what to do with the property, he said. I know it is going to take a lot of money, and there should be thoughtful decisions about how to invest in that or think what else is to be done with it. High school softball. Experience Portsmouth knocks off Barrington 6-2. Wednesday afternoon offered a lesson for a young Barrington softball team. Matching up with veterans means needing to be sharp from the outset. Portsmouth jumped on the Eagles in the bottom of the first inning and just about put this Division II contest away. The Patriots used three errors and a three-run triple by Kylie Toner to build what turned out to be a decisive lead. Mia Ruggieri handled the rest in the circle as Portsmouth eased to a 6-2 home victory under sunny skies on April 8th. No one really sees them coming, Ruggieri said, but they are a really good hitting team. It was really important for us to get out early and take advantage of the opportunities we had. The Eagles recorded two quick outs before finding serious trouble in the first. Barbara Rainey's infield single, two errors, and a fielder's choice that didn't record an out loaded the bases for Toner. She slashed a drive to the right that found the grass and rolled toward the fence, handing the Patriots a 4-0 cushion. I went up there hoping to make contact, Toner said. Honestly, I just kind of did it and went from there. Portsmouth added another run on an error and turned things over to Ruggieri, who allowed just three singles and a walk through the first four innings. Barrington put together a threat by loading the bases with nobody out in the top of the second, but Ruggieri strung together three straight strikeouts to escape. She fanned 11 against two walks while keeping the Patriots in front throughout. My mindset is always to try to go one pitch at a time, Ruggieri said. Don't look at the bigger picture. It is what it is. Ruggieri helped herself in the bottom of the fourth when an infield out gave Portsmouth a 6-0 lead. The Eagles clawed a couple of runs back thanks to Grace Fontaine, who drove one in on a hard infield single in the fifth and drilled a two-out solo homer to left in the seventh. Ruggieri recorded the final out on a fly to right, and the Patriots banked an early win against a fellow playoff qualifier from last season. I think we all have confidence in her, Toner said. She has us, and we definitely all have her back behind her. I think that's what makes us a team, a real team. Fontaine was one of five sophomores who started for Barrington in this one, and the Eagles also featured four first-year players in their lineup. Senior catcher Maya Etheridge stood out thanks to her experience and a 2-for-3 effort out of the cleanup spot. Barrington lost a 10-inning heartbreaker to Johnston in last year's postseason opener and was eventually eliminated by East Greenwich. Portsmouth enjoyed a deeper run, winning three straight games in the loser's bracket before falling to West Warwick. The Patriots knocked out Tollgate, the Panthers, and the Avengers before the Wizards proved too much. Ruggieri and Rainey form an all-senior battery that has been together since third grade. I think all of us are just so close, Ruggieri said. We don't really have that many underclassmen, but even the underclassmen, we've been playing together for so long. Judge halts processing of cannabis licenses. none of the 20 promised dispensary licenses for new recreational cannabis stores in Rhode Island will be issued anytime soon after a federal judge issued a preliminary injunction against the state's law dictating how they will be awarded. U.S. District Judge Melissa DuBose entered the preliminary injunction on April 8th, blocking the state from selecting lottery applicants, processing any applications under the current licensing scheme, proceeding with the current applicants or licensing. The order once again brings the long-delayed rollout of new recreation cannabis dispensaries to a halt. Here's what to know. How did we get here? The order comes after three lawsuits challenging the state's special process for so-called social equity licenses. DuBose had previously dismissed those lawsuits, but the First Circuit Court of Appeals sent the cases back to her and ordered her to adjudicate the case on the merits of the Dormant Commerce Clause. The Dormant Commerce Clause is an implied restriction on the ability of states to pass legislation that discriminates against or excessively burdens interstate commerce, according to the Cornell Law School Legal Information Institute. DuBose initially had found that the defendants, who are from California and Florida, didn't have standing to sue because they never took any actual steps to have viable applications, such as getting a lease for a space or a zoning certificate. But the appeals court ruled that, in order to sue, the defendants only needed to say that they want to apply for a license and then be disqualified. Why stop all licenses? While the headline in the three lawsuits is their challenge to the state's social equity applications, DuBose noted that the state's residency requirement is just as problematic, if not more so. Under the current law, 51% of a company needs to be owned by a Rhode Island resident, although the remaining 49% can be owned by someone out of state. In granting the preliminary injunction, DuBose found that there is a likelihood that the three lawsuits will succeed in overturning the state's law requiring that 51% of a dispensary be owned by a Rhode Island resident because that violates the Dormant Commerce Clause per the First Circuit Court of Appeals. DuBose also found that the two Californians and one Floridian suing the estate will suffer irreparable injury absent injunctive relief because the Cannabis Control Commission won't hold any new lotteries or application periods, even though only 20 of the 24 allowed licenses were set to be awarded. She wrote that knowing that the state law was facing legal challenges, the Cannabis Control Commission proceeded anyway. The resulting fallout will be, to be blunt, self-inflicted, DuBose wrote. Could these new proposals solve the residency issue? Companion bills have been introduced in the General Assembly to remove the residency requirement from state law. Both have had their first committee hearings, but have no new hearings scheduled. What's not clear is what happens if those bills pass and the residency requirements are eliminated. The Cannabis Control Commission would need to change its rules, and DuBose ordered that the Cannabis Control Commission can't go forward with the current application or licensing period, including 1, holding the lottery to select applicants, and 2, processing any application submitted under the current licensing period for both adult use and social equity licenses. In comments submitted for the House bill, the American Civil Liberties Union of Rhode Island wrote that eliminating the residency requirement only goes halfway. As the appellate court noted, some of the standards for qualifying for a social equity license are exclusively related to Rhode Island residency. However, this legislation leaves those standards in place, and we therefore believe that the statute could continue to subject to constitutional challenge, according to the ACLU testimony. If the General Assembly wants to end the legal challenges, it needs to re-examine the social equity standards in the statute and consider whether they also need to be amended to avoid Commerce Clause or other constitutional pitfalls, the ACLU testimony said. During a March 12th hearing, Representative Scott Slater, Democrat Providence, who introduced H7410, said the residency requirements have been a losing battle in other states and removing them might allow the process to go forward. weighing one harm against another. DuBose acknowledged that the theoretical harm that the people who thought about applying would face considering the residency requirement is weighed against the strong mandate in the state rules that require applicants to pay on leases or promissory leases for property and other costs associated with having a location ready before winning the lottery. Cooperative applicant Andre Dev said allowing out-of-state applicants to apply now would hugely advantage them because they know where other cooperatives have their leases. It's not fair to let them come in at the last minute when others have put in time and money, and a lot of that is unique to Rhode Island, as other states don't require site approval and lease agreements, Dev said. In Baltimore, social equity applicants just pay $5,000 to apply. The Cannabis Control Commission will have to make hard decisions about the people who have already applied, as many may decide to stop paying or let go of their leases as they bleed money with no lottery date in sight, he said. Whatever the solution is, it needs to honor all the money that the current slate of applicants have spent to meet the state and the Cannabis Control Commission's requirements, Deb said. Cannabis Control Commission tried to slow roll applications. While the total pause on the current application period is self-inflicted, as DuBose wrote, the Cannabis Control Commission was already trying to slow down the issuance of licenses because of conflicts among the state's existing dispensaries, which are concerned about the competition, and the state's cultivators, or cannabis growers and processors, who need more dispensaries to sell their products to and have warned they will go out of business if the process drags on.